Well, the idea here today is that you talk and ask questions and express yourself. Let me tell you just a little bit about what we're hoping to accomplish this morning and in any other of these get-togethers. I think one of the things that has occurred to me as I've listened to you, students and faculty and staff, is that there's a lot of interest in things that are going on in the Synod and at the seminary, a feeling that you'd like to know more about not only synodical problems, but also the seminary. What are we doing about staffing, and what about some of the other problems that are very apparent? And a feeling that you need somebody to listen to you and somebody to hear your suggestions, and let's work together and make the school a better place, but also to share ideas about the Synod. Back in 1974, when we were putting the school back together again, or trying to, we frequently met up here and did this kind of thing. I don't know, we did it at least three or four times, I believe, just in the fall of the year. And I would usually say a few things about happenings at the seminary or in the Synod, and then guys would ask questions or make statements, and we had a lot of free give and take. And I think it's one of the regrettable things of the last few years that perhaps largely because of my heavy off-campus schedule, which I don't like any better than my wife or kids, that we haven't done that kind of thing as much as we should. So what we have planned to do was to try it out today and see once whether you like the idea. And if you do, we meaning Gladys and I, have looked at the calendar and have tentatively reserved two other dates between now and the end of year to do the same thing. The theory being that as we go into the Dallas Convention, we have a lot of questions about fellowship with the American Lutheran Church, or the new hymnal, or LACUSA, or certification of Seminex guys, or just 101 things about the Synod that you might like to talk about. And since I am still pretty heavily involved in most of the church relations activities of the Synod and some of the theological ones, I'd be real happy to clue you in on the little bit that I'm involved in, and perhaps we can get some things going. So the idea is to talk to one another. It's not just ask the president, that's part of it, I guess, but you can ask each other or tell the president too, or tell each other. We in the administration need to hear where you are, what your concerns are, what your questions are. So please feel free, after I say just a few comments about things that I think might be of general interest, feel free to say anything that's on your mind. And don't hold back at all. A few comments generally about the SEM, and then we'll start fielding questions. Some of you have been asking about enrollment figures here, and I would say at this point, present enrollment, I believe, is 365. We've had a very modest increase since the first quarter, but our projections for next year, again, look very good. I think it's quite safe to predict an enrollment of 400 or perhaps 410 for next year. And we are very encouraged by that. We've been making a number of visits to college campuses, chiefly within the system. Our figures coming from the Fort Wayne Senior College campus are very encouraging. Apparently, we're holding our own there in spite of the fact that that class is right on the campus of the seminary at Fort Wayne. And we're very encouraged by that. And we seem to be doing fairly well in other synodical schools as well as in some of the non-synodical schools. The Lord has been extremely good to us in sending so many men to work with us in these difficult days of growth and rebuilding. So we're pleased. If only each one of you here and each student at Fort Wayne could bring with you one more to do something about the growing demand for pastors in the church, that would truly be a blessing. The estimate that many of us are making is that by summer we will have 600 parishes in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod which are vacant. And this comes at a time when the mission fields of the church are calling for men in a way that just boggles my mind. 2 years ago, I would never have thought that there would be much demand for expatriate missionaries, particularly with some of the anti-colonialist attitudes that have surfaced, and attitudes toward the white man, toward the American. And I don't need to regale you with stories of what has gone on in Africa, Liberia, in the Batak churches of Indonesia, Philippines, but no fewer than 44 requests for foreign calls have come from the Board for Missions. They would like 28 of those from the seminaries. And I see this as a tremendous opportunity for the church, and one that just really causes me to weep almost when you stop to think that this is coming at a time when we can't even fill our own pulpits. So recruitment is high on my list of priorities, and one of the things that I am doing with my time when I'm not on campus is telling people all over the church to send us their sons and grandsons and brothers, congregations to set up scholarship funds and make it possible for this sort of thing to happen. And I'd like to plead with you not simply to sit back and say, well, enrollment is pretty good and growing, because we're not growing fast enough at either seminary to meet the tremendous demand that there is for pastors. A second thing, I think many of you are talking to me about the staffing situation on the faculty of the seminary. You have to really be a slow student to realize or to think that we're all set in terms of the staff, particularly in the area of systematic theology, where, as you know, our regular faculty numbers only three people, Dr. Klan, Professor Eichmann, and I. And I haven't taught a course for 5 years, it dawned on me the other day. I'm not sure that I even know where to find things anymore. I do know that that red book on the shelf used to hold the confessions of our church. I assume it still does, but I haven't used it academically for quite some time. And if it had not been for the availability of good men like Drs. Vart and Petsch, even got my aunt in there. I did that for Mrs. Petsch because she understands German. Reasonably well. She's learning, and I'm very happy about that. If it weren't for the availability and the kindness of people like this and the places they serve to release these good people to help us out for a time, it really would have been very, very difficult. So I want to tell you a little bit about what we have been doing in staffing and some of the needs that we still have, and I do this just both to inform and to invite you to call names to my attention or to the attention of Dean Klotz or Department Chairman so that we can continue to pick out people for the faculty who are both qualified academically and qualified in terms of their pastoral commitments to the task of training pastors. You have probably heard by this time that we have had an acceptance from Professor Quentin Wesselschmidt in the area of historical theology. Professor Wesselschmidt will be receiving his doctorate from Iowa University in early church history and classics, and we expect him to be teaching primarily in the area of early church history. He's, I would guess, 39 or 40, seems like a very, very fine man, and a likable one on top of it. So we're happy that we'll be plugging one small hole in historical theology that way. We also now have a commitment from Dr. Daniel Overduin, O-V-E-R-D-U-I-N, from our sister church in Australia. Dr. Overduin will be here as a guest professor of systematic theology next year, teaching primarily in the field of systematic theology 1 and 2 and 3, I think, as well as some course or a course or two in Christian ethics. His primary academic field is Christian ethics. He comes out of the Reformed tradition originally, became a Lutheran in Australia, and has his doctorate from a Catholic university. He's a very interesting and highly rated man, and we feel with his background he fits our general ecumenical image at Concordia. Also in the area of systematic theology, we are all but sure at this point of two other individuals who will be teaching in each quarter. One is Dr. Fred Precht, who has his doctorate in systematic theology from this seminary and taught at the Springfield Seminary for many years in the area of worship, then served as their director of seminary relations. He was also director of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Foundation for an interim period. He is now in the city of St. Louis and working with the World Home Bible League, but he will be available for one course a quarter, and he brings a considerable amount of competence to that area. Another man that will be here, we're not quite sure whether we can get him in the fall quarter yet, and that is the former professor from Seward, Arnold Krugler, who is spoken well of by those of you who have had him at Seward, by his colleagues there, and by many others. Arnold Krugler has accepted a call to a parish in Illinois. He would be serving us probably on one day a week as a commuting professor. Another one who we have, I think again, all but signed everything that needs to be nailed down is Dr. Robert McAmis, who has just retired as the, or stepped down would be a more accurate verb, as the president of our Philippine Lutheran Church. He has his doctorate from this institution in systematics. He's an excellent missionary. He has spent most of his missionary work among the Muslims in the Philippines, and we're going to be seeing something of him next year on this campus in both systematics and, we think, perhaps an elective in missions. We are looking at two other people, and looking at does not mean we've extended a call. And if you know these people, I would appreciate any comments you have about them. One is a possible addition to the faculty as a director of seminary relations, and this is Professor Clyde Kaminska of Concordia in Bronxville. We have been negotiating with the Board for Higher Education. His position would be primarily administrative. Dr. Kaminska did his doctoral dissertation at Columbia on ministerial recruitment, and one of the things we would look for in him if he came here would be a well-organized synodical effort to reach very young men, high school age and college age, to attract them for the ministry and not just to attract men to come to this institution. He looks pretty good to us, and we think we may be extending a call to him in April. But I, again, please do not report that he has a call. He does not. It would be embarrassing to do that, I think, for him and for us. And then the other man that we're looking at the present time and very hopeful that he will be available, I'm all but sure that he will, next year as a part-time visiting professor is a black man who is Dr. Robert King, presently serving as the director of the Graduate School of Lincoln University in Jefferson City, has his doctorate in education and a master's in religious education, man of about, John, would you say 52, 53, 55? A very, very fine man, and we're hoping to have him not only as a teacher on our campus next year in a part-time capacity, but also to have him in a consulting capacity in the area of black ministries, as well as in continuing education. His academic specialty is adult education. So we are at work, and while it may seem that the gaps are very, very large, we are aware of many of them, and we are trying to do our best to fill them with good men, interesting men, dedicated men, and men who share the theological confessional basis of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We know, of course, that some holes remain, and your suggestions in these areas are welcome. Professor Warnick, as you know, has accepted a call to the Ladue congregation, and so we will be looking for a new director of vicarage. That man could be appointed from within the faculty, or he could be called from outside the faculty. And I think you can imagine the kind of man we're looking for. We're looking for a seasoned pastor who also relates well to students and relates well to district presidents and bishops. It takes a certain type of individual. Professor Wallenberg, as you probably have heard, will be accepting a position with the military this summer. He's been in chaplaincy reserve for a number of years, and he has felt that his career needs to try the full-time chaplaincy for a while. And so we will also be looking for someone to assist us in recruitment. That person could again come from the present staff, or it could be a new person. And some months ago, I don't know where the Rev is here, maybe 3 months ago, Professor Rosso asked me to appoint someone else as director of worship next year so that he could spend more time teaching. He would like to teach full time, and many months ago I said, that's fine, we will be looking for someone else. Again, this could be a person presently on the faculty, it could be a new person. In fact, one of the interesting things I'd like to visit with students about is the whole area of pastoral relationships on campus, advisor, advisee relationships, worship life, spiritual life, community, and that kind of thing. Because I frankly think that we're a little bit at low ebb and need to do something about it. A couple of quickies. I think you know that Fritz Hall is presently being gutted in order to provide 10 married student apartments. We expect that work to be completed in Fritz Hall by the end of August. But what you may not know is that within just a few weeks, we think by mid-April, we hoped to sign a contract for the construction of the new married student unit on San Benito. Both of these units are being financed by gifts from private individuals. In fact, one man is responsible for approximately $250,000 of this $450,000 construction project. And the net increase for the seminary will be 22 new apartments. We will be losing 4 because of the building that's going to be ripped down on San Benito. So it's a net gain, and we're very, very grateful to this man and to others in the church who have made it possible. Well, there are a lot of things to talk about, and I did promise you the opportunity to ask questions. I have been hearing a lot of comments from students when I'm around about a lot of things. I don't know whether it's partly attributable to the long, cold winter. January and February have always been kind of rough months. But I would just say, by way of inviting your comments and questions, that I am very much aware of the fact that there's a lot of unhappiness about some testing procedures and grading procedures and attitudes that you discern among your fellow students or faculty, feeling that we don't have quite enough life in the community at the present time. I think we're all pretty much aware of this kind of thing. And I believe maybe one positive outcome out of this morning's visit together would be if we could find some suggestions to improve our life together at Concordia Seminary. Well, let me pause and try to field questions. Who wants to lead off with a question or a comment? Okay, please.
Would it be possible for the seminary to examine ways that the prices of books in the bookstore might be lowered? I was thinking in terms of perhaps establishing a foundation that would partially subsidize the bookstore. I understand they just received, where they used to get a 40% discount on the books, now they only get a 25%. And it's kind of frustrating to want to build up a library while you are here and not be able to do that because of the high cost. Is there anything being studied in that way, or could it be?
Well, I think it's a very interesting question. I don't want to lose any good questions this morning. Roland, whenever a question comes in your area, would you please make notes of it? And John, if it's academic, would you please make note? Any of you on the faculty or staff who need to follow through on something, let's please do it. On the bookstore... on the bookstore, all I can say by all that I know of that has been done is that we have been doing what we've called a management study on certain phases of the seminary's operation, and one of those is the bookstore. We are aware of the fact that prices are higher on some of our items than they are in other student bookstores in the area. We feel that through I think, one of the casualties of the break, largely, but we're carrying too large an inventory. We have some management problems, some questions about staffing. But your particular idea, if I'm hearing you right, is that it would, in effect, subsidize the cost of books so that students could build a library. This would be kind of a quasi-scholarship thing. I think it's a very intriguing idea. I know where I studied, when I studied at Yale, they had a different arrangement than we have there, have here in the bookstore. It was, in effect, a corporation that students joined. You paid like 10 bucks to join. It was called a co-op. And you not only bought your books at a pretty good price, but at the end of the year, you got a share of any profits came back to the students. I think there are things like this that do need investigation. Roland, do you know of anything beyond this in the bookstore or in the financial aid? Has any study ever been done here this year on along the lines of the question?
Nothing to my knowledge. We are dimly aware of possibilities, but they have not been actively pursued.
But it's a good suggestion. Okay, who has another one? Yes.
Yes, for the summer schedule, there's a professor, Felber?
Yes, Paul Felber.
Paul Felber. And is he being looked at as a future profiteer?
Well, I suppose we're always doing that with summer school profs. It's, you know, I think we're pretty open about that. We tell people that come in for the summers that we're interested in seeing how they relate to students, how they handle the material. Professor Felber is a prof at Ann Arbor and presently serving as chairman of the Synod's Commission on Worship. I don't think we have not approached Paul in any direct way for a position in worship. It's a possibility. I think he remains certainly a candidate for that kind of position. John, do you know any more about Dr. Felber than that?
Well, that's correct. I might say, that I've got two drawers full of potential faculty members. I guess we've got about 200 on the list. And we are very conscientious in following up recommendations, and we will very much appreciate your suggestions and your recommendations because we've gotten some very excellent ones from our students.
These will be for many courses. I mean, if you can get them in a file drawer. Yes, please.
Along the same line, what is the present position of Professor Wayne Schmidt, and is John Johnson being looked at?
Yes. Let me talk about both. Wayne Schmidt is now a full-fledged member of the faculty. He is no longer a visiting professor. He's in residence, just as he was when he was visiting. except that now he's officially settled in. So Wayne is here and here to stay. And Wayne remains, it seems to me, a man that we count on to do things not only in worship, but in his primary field, which is education. John Johnson, as you know, is a graduate student at the seminary, not to mention St. Louis University, man we think very highly of. And our Board of Control has voted to extend a call to him as an assistant professor of systematic and historical theology, and authorized the president to extend the call when I feel that he has established his receipt of his degree, or some such wording. And I don't know exactly what that means, except that it is a recognition of the highly unusual nature of such a call. Ordinarily, an institution does not call one of its own students as a professor. It's indicative of the fact both that John Johnson is a very talented young man, which is no great secret to anybody, but also of the tremendous need we have to staff this faculty. John is, might as well tell it publicly, John has recently turned down a position with the Missouri Synod's Task Force on Constitution, Bylaws, and Structure. The congregation where he's been serving as assistant pastor would dearly love to call him as associate pastor. I know of at least two synodical schools that are waiting to see what he does with our offer, because if he doesn't get this one and take it, he will get one there. So, If I could play the role of prophet, I would predict that John's call will be extended to him in April for next year. And God willing, and with good success, John will be teaching full-time in historical and systematic next year. Hi, who's got another one? Yes.
There have been some rumors floating around about the possibility of an addition in financial aid as housing, a new staff person there. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I have interviewed one person. When I interview a person, it means they're pretty far down the line in a pretty toward being given a position. Gotta watch that. We have about five candidates for a new position. This is not to replace Mrs. Freimark, but to expand the staff. Position of, I can just imagine what some. You really want to hear a good one, you should talk, ask Bill Schmeller to tell you a story sometime. But the idea would be to increase the staff in that area. And the way in which we're thinking, the way in which I am thinking about the position, let me tell you a little bit about it, is first of all, I want a person in this position who can not only administer scholarship, student aid, and loan funds, and not only assign rooms and dormitories, but go out on the other end of the game and become a broker for housing. That is to, I have often felt, I don't know why we have to wait the 7 or 8 years it's going to take us to gather money and build new buildings for married students. It seems to me with all the apartments in the area, the seminary is in a very favorable position for making some hard commitments to some apartment owners in the area whereby we would guarantee occupancy for a certain amount per year, and they in turn would guarantee maintenance. Washington University has begun to do this in the University City area. I think we can do it too. It takes some person, though, with a little bit of time to get out there and do it. And then on student aid and scholarship funds, I want somebody to raise the money as well as to spend it. And I think that we can do that. I think we can increase student aid funds considerably. We're going to need to do it in order to survive. I think just about that strong. Senate is in a bad way financially. A lot of people don't realize it. This year, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has adopted a spending budget that is $3 million above the most optimistic estimate on receipts. I don't know how many years, or should I even move, I don't even know whether I should put it in the plural, whether the Synod can do that. And that may mean closing schools, it may mean lopping off staff, it may mean some pretty drastic solutions. I don't think the seminaries of the church stand to be closed. I really don't think that will happen. But when we ask for more subsidy to run the institution, to try to give cost of living increases to our faculty and staff, which we haven't even been able to do, it's very, very difficult when money isn't coming in. So our only alternative, it seems to me, is twofold. Or there are two alternatives. One is to go out and beat the bushes and try to raise money, which is one reason I'm gone so much. We need to raise $200,000 this year just to pay the lights and that kind of thing. We'll have to increase that considerably, which is why I'm planning to expand the development department. And the other alternative is to increase student fees, which is what almost every educational institution in the country is doing. We have opted for a very token increase of a dollar or a dollar and a half, a quarter hour from time to time, but it isn't beginning to keep pace. So it seems to me the reason I'm going in some detail is to show you why I want an expanded student aid program, not only in terms of expenditures, but in solicitation of income, because I think what we're going to have to do is to increase fees, but increase student aid so that student aid funds come right back into the seminary to pay the cost of salaries and so on. And this position, I'm interviewing a man for it who's a very, the man I interviewed is, I think, a very qualified layman. I have also talked to him and one other man who will probably be coming in for an interview within the next few weeks about another role I would like this individual to play. I have described it as a kind of student advocate. When you get done from the business office, you know, pay me what thou owest. You can't register until you've done this and that, or if your living conditions in the dorms or in the apartments are not good, not adequate, this person would be the student's representative, so to speak. He could say, don't worry about it, I'll get you the money, or I'll get you a loan, I'll look into the condition in the dorm. He would be charged with improving of the improvement of the quality of life in our housing, both single and married. So yes, I am looking. If you know of a person who has some experience in the financial world, this would be very helpful. Someone who relates well to students, who has the kind of personality that would enable him to make appeals to people for money, and who could be a student-oriented administrator. He would be paid by the administrator to make student life more enjoyable. So we are looking. Yes, please.
Maybe something along that same line. You said you didn't think that they were going to drop the seminaries, but it doesn't take too much of a financial wizard to see that what we have now is two seminaries doing essentially the same thing. And what do you see as the future of St. Louis Seminary to make it different from Fort Wayne? The enrollment here is changing to look more and more like that of Fort Wayne Seminary, mm-hmm. as far as who they're picking up and who we have here. I wonder what you see as the difference between the two.
That's the question you've addressed about the difference between the two is one that is discussed by the presidents whenever we have an opportunity, and in fact by the Board for Higher Education. A meeting was held on this campus Saturday involving Dr. Robert Preuss and President Merlin Pohl, Allschwede, Schultz of the BHE staff, and Ray Halm, a member of the BHE, to discuss that very question. You know, what is the future direction of seminary education, and what is the status of the system, as it used to be called? There's a great deal of uncertainty. I mean, uncertainty at the highest levels in the church as to what this future ought to be. If I were to characterize what I think is the consensus in that group that met, and I think it does represent those currently responsible for theological education and the system, it would be that the system as we have known it is no more and probably will not be revived. We no longer have this seminary as the end institution of a preferred route. You have two seminaries, fully accredited, both viable for entrance into the ministry of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, both accepting students from within the system and outside the system, and with some differences in style and admissions standards and so on, but basically not too different. And the question is, first of all, is that the way it ought to be? Should one seminary concentrate on system students and the other on non-system students? Is one question that is asked. Generally, it's answered in the negative. As far as the system is concerned, the big question is whether Ann Arbor should be the preferred senior college, in the same sense that Fort Wayne was prior to its becoming a seminary. And there are very mixed feelings about that. I think the Anaheim Resolution in 1975 envisaged that Ann Arbor would be the preferred senior college route, probably to St. Louis. And that began breaking down immediately after the convention when Fort Wayne made it very clear that it also wanted to be the preferred end product of that route. And then I think the other thing we're finding, and Dave could, I think, reinforce it from visits to the colleges of the Synod, that there are really five colleges that have ministerial students in the student body: Bronxville, River Forest, Seward, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Ann Arbor. And we find a large amount of interest in each of these campuses, not only in guys who want to be pastors, but in faculty members who want to offer a ministerial route. We talked to 42, wasn't it, at River Forest? and most of them were juniors and seniors. And it's about the same number of students at Seward, Bronxville, and so on. And what you're finding is many students who find it financially advantageous to stay there after their sophomore year because of a state scholarship or something, or simply because they like the school, they like the faculty, and they're not going to be told to transfer to Ann Arbor for their junior and senior year. You have the president of St. Paul, Minnesota, Dr. Hyatt, who was formerly the chief of chaplains of the United States military establishment and a general, saying, I don't care if the BHE says we can't teach Hebrew, we're teaching Hebrew. And they are teaching Hebrew with, I think, 24 students, you know, or 26 or something, in their Hebrew class at St. Paul, Minnesota. Bronxville is teaching Hebrew. River Forest offers Hebrew as an independent study. I think the only school that's not doing it right now is Seward, and they would like to. Well, while all this is going on, everybody wonders. Ann Arbor says, well, are we getting the shaft, you know? Or I think one of the culprits in the whole thing is perhaps the seminary. Are the seminaries, because we're both doing it. System students say, what's the advantage in going to a system college or colleges? The seminaries treat us both alike when we get to the seminary. And so a lot of the discussion is in the nature of the seminaries offering more enriched programs for system students, or for students out of the system who have who meet competency tests and so on in certain areas, so that at the seminary what we might be going to in a year or two would be some kind of testing device to determine whether, let us say, the area where I taught in symbolics, whether you go into a section that is a survey of the Lutheran confessions, or a survey that's really a seminar on selected problems in the confessions based upon a good strong religion major and a knowledge of the survey. The same thing could be done in Old Testament, New Testament introduction courses, historical theology courses, and perhaps some others. So there is a lot of curriculum shuffling, homogeneous grouping, competency-based testing programs being evaluated to see whether some differentiation can be made at the seminary in its curriculum. But if you're really going to, you know, what's really happening is that the matter is being studied. There is no real certainty, I regret to say, as to what the direction should be. I tend, by the way, my position, I tend to take the position that all five colleges of the synod should be permitted to have ministerial students, and that each of them should be encouraged to develop what I would call a preferred theological curriculum rather than a preferred theological route. The curriculum would have a core with considerable number of options. I no longer feel that that every student necessarily has to have 14 hours of German or 12 hours of German, perhaps a concentration in education or a concentration in psychology and sociology or something of that kind would be just as useful for certain types of ministry. That remains a kind of a personal opinion, and at this point is not universally or even semi-universally accepted. Part of my plan, I'm not trying to undercut Ann Arbor. I think Ann Arbor should continue to be the focal point in our college system and should be developed as a pre-ministerial school par excellence. But I see no point in closing down the pastoral option to students presently enrolled in our other colleges. They do have good faculties, and I see no reason why they couldn't offer a fine pre-seminary curriculum. I won't be so long-winded on the rest, really. Who else has a question or two? Yes?
What determines whether a course should be a 3-credit course or a 4-credit course? And does the workload have a part in this decision making?
I'm going to let John Klotz. There's Here's a little story. I told it last night about the guy that drove me from the airport to this lecture at River Forest, and I told him chauffeurs always have a rough role to play, and I could illustrate it by a story. I'll tell you that one, and it won't take too long. If you please be polite and laugh, or I will I'll turn Chris Dodge loose on you. The Roman Catholic bishop had decided to go on a tour of his diocese. It had several hundred parishes in the diocese, and he had his chauffeur drive him around in his Lincoln. And after he had gone to about 40 places in 40 places in 50 days or something, he got very tired of making the same speech over and over again about what was going on in the Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church. And he said to Bill, his chauffeur, "Bill, you know, you've heard my speech so often. Why don't you try this tomorrow night? I'm really getting tired of talking, and people don't know me anyhow. They'll think you're me." So the next night, despite of Bill's protest, I mean, he knew who was paying his check and all that, Bill puts on the cross and the collar and all the purple and all of that, so everybody would know he was of the hierarchy. And he went through the speech, did a pretty good job, a little bit nervous, and finished a little early. So the chairman, you know, good old chairman in his fashion, says, "Well, the good bishop likes to answer questions from the audience. So any of you have a question you'd like to ask the good bishop, I'm sure he'd be happy to answer it for you." And sure enough, wouldn't you know it, right back in the corner was a bright young, let's say a seminary student, who thought, well, maybe he'd have a chance here to impress the bishop. So he stood up and cleared his voice, you know, with the usual histrionics that have to accompany a profound question, puffed on his pipe, stroked his beard, did all of these things. And in his most profound bass voice, he said, "Your Eminence, I wonder if you'd care to comment on the relationship, however remote it might be, between Sartrean existentialism and the conflict in Southeast Asia." These questions get wilder all the time as I tell this story. And the poor chauffeur scratches his chin and he says, "Well, yeah," he says, "that's a good question. That's really a really a good question. Matter of fact, as I've been going around the diocese, it's been asked me several times." And people are always surprised at how simple this question really is. It is really not that difficult to answer. In fact, it's so easy to answer, I'm going to ask my chauffeur to take it. Now, John, you haven't driven me anywhere except bats a couple of times. Would you care to comment? What's the difference between a 4-hour and a 3-hour course?
That's a good question. But seriously, this is a matter that is being discussed by the departments, and the courses are being reviewed. The idea is that the student is expected to do more work and to be exposed to more classes in the 4-hour course than in the 3-hour course. I think it's fair to say that the departments are looking very hard at the 4-hour courses. There are a number of them that are being recommended that they be reduced to 3-hour courses, with the idea that there will be more electivity within the program. This is the way in which we're moving. We want to provide more options as a minimum, and hopefully also more free electives in the program. We do not want to increase the number of hours required for graduation. So if you're trying to do that, you're going to have to cut back somewhere. And what we are hoping to do is to cut back on the number of 4-hour courses so that almost the standard will be a 3-hour course, and provide for more options and more electivity in the program.
And I think if you have specific questions or suggestions about a given course, if you think a 3-hour course is so useful that it should be expanded, or 4-hour course is not that useful, it could be curtailed, perhaps the best way to get something moving would be to talk to one of the three department chairmen, to Dr. Augie Soflo in historical systematics, to Bob Herber in exegetical, or to Rudy Harm in the practical area. Theoretically, the difference represents the faculty's and Board of Higher Education's estimate of the amount of material and the quantity of objectives to be met in a given course. I think these things do need review from time to time, and if you have suggestions, they will be welcomed. Yes?
I've been looking forward to the opportunity to go home during the break and spread the good news about the
I can believe. Oh, I thought that was the end of the comment.
And I want to be prepared to do that. One question that I have comes to mind and I expect people to ask centers around the controversy, the break. People want to know still, and I think they'd be glad to hear it from the president now. What basically happened, why, what were the results, and what are the likely...
That reminds me of a question I had in a graduate school examination. Describe the universe. In 50 words.
That's why I have trouble handling it myself. The question that repeatedly comes up, gets right down to the nitty-gritty, is people want to know, were there teachers among the old faculty who are putting out false doctrine or dangerous doctrine, and without identifying names, if you don't want to, could you identify the doctrine?
Okay, I don't know, that's hard for me to answer without revealing and betraying my own intimate personal involvement during those years. So I wouldn't even try not to, try to be objective. But I think the question of whether the former faculty taught false doctrine is complex because of the events of New Orleans and reactions of the faculty prior to New Orleans and after it, and the way the former faculty has participated or refused to participate, as the case might be, in various reconciliation efforts that were made after that time. There is the fact, to talk about something that's objective, it is a fact that the New Orleans Convention adopted Resolution 3-09, which describes what it describes a doctrinal position as being contrary to the position of the Lutheran Church. And it attributes that position to the faculty that was here at the time. The Commission on Constitutional Matters had to rule on that resolution as to whether or not it made charges or accusations of false doctrine and to decide just exactly what it did do. The ruling, and this constitutes the official position on that resolution, is that that resolution does condemn a stance, I think is the noun that's used. John, you are very familiar with that, the stance of the former faculty. But it also goes on to say that the resolution did not charge individuals, did not charge persons either individually or collectively with false teachers. And that what was needed was for a process to take place by which the Board of Control, as those who were then the supervisors of the doctrine of these men, that the Board of Control needed to engage in an interview and examination of written material kind of process to see whether the individuals really held the positions that the Synod found to be wrong. So you have this tension between people and positions, and you have the tension between a statement of a convention and the failure of a process to be enacted that the resolution called for, because the former faculty did not come under that kind of process, with the exception of a couple of people. We began the process with Ed Krentz, but Ed Krentz resigned in the middle of it, and that means it reached no determination. On the other hand, the statement is frequently made by Seminex students, and it was at the time of the walkout, that the Board of Control would not tell them who was guilty of false doctrine. Now that is a very strange statement, because at that point no one had been condemned or even charged with false doctrine. The process had not been begun. The ruling of the Commission on Constitutional Matters was not issued until February 12, 1974, right in the middle of the moratorium. But it really was no great mystery then, nor is it now, who signed the statements of the former faculty that are quoted in Resolution 309. There are statements of the faculty that are criticized, cited in the resolution as being contrary to the Senate's position. So I guess in a shorthand way, you can't give people that kind of a long-winded answer or they'll fall asleep or something. It seems to me that what we have is, and I'm trying to talk without personal involvement. I could tell you all kinds of things that were said in coffee break or in the classroom where I team taught and things of that kind that I do consider contrary to the doctrine of our church body. But officially, what the Senate has done is to say that certain statements, certain positions expressed by the former faculty are wrong. But it has not said that those men are false teachers. There is a difference. The difference is the difference between what St. Augustine already distinguished as the objective and subjective elements in heresy. The objective element is the thing that is said or the statement that is made that is wrong. But a person who does that, who holds or utters an objectively false statement, is not a heretic or even a false teacher until he does so pertinaciously. That's the subjective element. Until he continues to do this in spite of frequent admonitions and in spite of the judgment of his peers using the word of God with him. And it's that latter thing that has not yet happened. And I think it's one of the great tragedies, frankly, of the controversy, that so much energy has been expended and so much blood has been shed, at least figuratively, and we haven't really nailed this thing down once and for all as to where this controversy stands in terms of doctrine. I don't know if that helps. It is an ambiguous answer, and I think it's best to give not an ambiguous response to questions that you get in the field, but to say something along the lines that the church said certain things that were being taught were wrong, and yet the people have never been found guilty, officially charged, and so on. I guess it's one other point on that. The Anaheim Convention set up a special committee to do this, since the Board of Control was no longer in charge. And this committee was the so-called Wiederenders Committee, chaired by the former first vice president of the Synod, now retired in Texas. And let's see, Herbert Berner. Anybody help me? There were three others. Jimmy Manns, I believe, of Chicago. 1, 2, 3. It was a very good committee, so good that Missouri in Perspective praised the makeup of it as being a fair committee, but the Seminex faculty declined to talk to these people individually, feeling that that would be an admission of false doctrine rather than a way of trying to clarify what they believed. And I regret that very much. I think that would have been a way of getting at this question. Yes. I wonder whether we could hold you in abeyance and give everybody who has a hand up a chance to speak once before anybody speaks twice. Would that be fair? Yes, the man in the corner, please.
There was a recent suggestion put out by one of the boards or committees of Synod concerning the relationship between the ALC as far as a recommendation towards the Dallas Convention. Putting it on 2-year probation or something like that. Could you explain that? What that means in terms of individual churches, things like that?
Be happy to. That's the kind of question, by the way, that I think would be, instead of a question-answer format, it would be fun. Pick it up again if we get together and just go back and forth in the group and see what you think about fellowship with the American Lutheran Church, and perhaps I could kind of provide some of the background for it, and then we could talk about what we think Dallas ought to do. I mean, after all, in a few years, in some cases a few months, you're going to be out there handling these questions yourself, and I think it would be awfully good to do that. Let me tell you, I have been on the Missouri Synod's Commission on Fellowship since Fellowship was established in 1969. And I am a member of the commission that made the recommendation that you just referred to, the Commission on Theology and Church Relations. In fact, I'm on the subcommittee that prepared the draft of the resolution. The resolution, the recommendation to the Synod, calls for the establishment of a state of protesting fellowship with the American Lutheran Church. It is not quite correct to interpret that action the way the Post-Dispatch did over the weekend, as though the Synod, if it bought that recommendation, and it doesn't have to, obviously, it can do what it wants. But the impression given in the Post by Jim Adams' article was that what the Commission on Theology was recommending was 2 years. You know, you're either show us that the doctrines held at the church body level and in the American Lutheran Church are in agreement with those of the Missouri Synod, or we have no choice but to quit or break off fellowship. That might be a result. But the commission's recommendation was not that final in 2 years. It simply said in 2 years that the Synod should reconsider its relationship, meaning let's talk about it again in 1979. The background for that resolution is that it's the finding of the so-called Commission on Fellowship and also concurred in by the CTCR that at the official church body level, the American Lutheran Church does not hold the doctrinal position of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, as has been evidenced in 8 years of discussions on the authority of Scripture, which was a problem already when fellowship was established in 1969, perhaps most notably in the discussions on the ordination of women, which became the policy of the American Lutheran Church in 1970, and which was reaffirmed by the American Lutheran Church in 1972, and which has been discussed in this commission by the theologians of the two church bodies quite a lot since that time, with the American Lutheran Church taking the position that it now takes the position it has restudied it, and it intends to continue with the ordination of women, feeling that St. Paul's words about the male-female relationship in the church were culturally conditioned. I think that's a fair general summary statement of their position, and that therefore they're free to do that. More recently, there's been quite a flap because of some statements by President David Preuss of the American Lutheran Church, in which he has accused the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod action in adopting a statement of having narrowed the confessional base of Lutheranism. And he has said that this action of the Missouri Synod is neither evangelical nor Lutheran. And those are very strong words. We have talked this over with David Preuss and with the commissioners from the American Lutheran Church. Dean Hopman is a member of that commission, and Professor Warnick is a member of that commission. We were all on it before Dean Hopman and Dick Warnick became members of this faculty. But the answer has been, yes, we agree with David Preuss, and the action of the Missouri Synod is one that they feel is wrong. So it's very difficult at the church body level to feel that there is agreement in doctrine between these two church bodies. In the Missouri Synod, altar and pulpit fellowship has always presupposed a rather comprehensive kind of agreement in doctrine and practice. It doesn't always mean that in the American Lutheran Church or in other church bodies. In fact, some of you may have heard or used the analogy that the president of the Michigan District of the American Lutheran Church used in 1968. After a discussion with Missouri, he said, in Missouri, altar and pulpit fellowship is like marriage, like a marriage relationship. It can't be any closer. In the American Lutheran Church, altar and pulpit fellowship is like holding hands during courtship. You know, it's a preliminary step that may lead to merger later on. So there's a different understanding there, to be sure. But in Missouri, it has always meant a complete agreement, relatively complete. I mean, whoever agrees with anybody and everything. But a relatively comprehensive agreement in doctrine and practice. For us to continue altar and pulpit fellowship without qualification at the church body level seemed to the Commission on Theology to be a compromise of our doctrinal integrity as a church body. But it weighed the question. It said, it looks to us like you could justify breaking it off completely. And yet we felt that there were three or four mitigating circumstances that should lead to a different conclusion and a more patient and pastoral solution, such as things like this, that in local areas, pastors and congregations of Missouri and ALC have found agreement and are today worshiping together, sharing a pastor, and doing some very fine things together. Why should that be destroyed, we reasoned, you know, if congregations have found doctrinal agreement? Or we recognize that there are many in the American Lutheran Church who do not share their church body's position on ordination of women or the attitude of some of their professors toward the authority of Scripture. And we wondered whether we had really been fair to those people without involving them in the discussion. We reckoned also that with the fact that in the Missouri Synod, there are many people who are not that conversant with the issues at the church body level. Should they not be brought into the discussion and attempted solution to the dilemma? So the resultant motion, namely to recommend that a state of protesting fellowship be established, was a way of saying, so the commission reasoned, a way of saying we have a serious problem at the church body level, a problem that we must protest. But let's do it patiently and comprehensively, recognizing that congregations and pastors who have found agreement can continue to practice fellowship while we work these things out. So the net effect of a state of protesting fellowship is not to say to the ALC in some legalistic way, you have 2 years to shape up or we're cutting it off. That's what Jim Adams wrote, and I think it's an overly harsh way of reading it. It's rather a way of keeping it alive without compromising our doctrinal position as a church body, but keeping it alive in a rather strong way to the American Lutheran Church, so that we will sit with them now and say, fellows, it's really gotten serious, this doctrinal thing, and we do want agreement and hope that we can get it very soon. Bruce, I think you've been flagging me down.
Could you comment upon the status and projection of the Greg Smith report on what transpired here 3 or 4 years ago, especially with the concern that as it reworked, do you feel it will be a candid report when it comes out? Yeah.
Well, when, not if. If you're curious about it, you should listen to the Board of Control. It isn't Greg's. There's no criticism of Greg. Greg has been assembling materials, not only for that report, but for posterity, for the archives. There will be, no doubt, many doctoral dissertations and articles written about this controversy in years to come, and many of the primary sources have been lying around in people's files or in TV studios and, you know, with the tapes and all that. And Greg's task has been to collect it, all of it, to talk to people, to get their slants on things, to gather and systematize, organize the data, and leave it behind for future people to work with. And while doing this, his task has also been to organize the data pertaining chiefly to the post 73 convention period, culminating in the walkout in January and February of 74. He has assembled, I don't know how many drafts at this time, that have been shared with the Board of Control. The difficulty is not finding the material. It's trying to hold it down to a reasonable minimum that people will read with some understanding and appreciation. And not put out a 10-volume work. And the Board of Control and I have shifted accents and emphases on Greg a number of times. At the present time, however, Greg and I are working with a mandate, I think is a pretty nice-sounding but strong word, from the Board of Control, that says in its April 15, 16 meeting, they want the final copy on their desks and want to approve it in that meeting. It would then go to the printer. We estimate 4 to 6 weeks of printing publication time, and it should be ready and mailed and available for sale about the 1st of June. We're predicting perhaps a 150-page paperback book. Will it be candid? It will be extremely factual in that it will quote, it will be footnoted, it will attempt to tell what went on in a without excessive rhetoric, without a lot of purple prose, without a lot of judgment, the idea being to tell the story, to narrate. One of the strengths of Greg's material, in my judgment, is the story he has of what went on in the student body in 73 and 74. He knew that because he was a student and has put together material that I've never seen anywhere else, and I think we'll find that rather interesting. But it will not be an expose. That's not the purpose of it. It is not an attempt to blacken people's name or to impugn character. It is simply to tell in sequence what went on and who was involved, and I think it will tell quite a lot, really, to the careful reader about why it went the way it did. Jim Adams' book is due out this week, I understand, and a book is being prepared. I have also heard by Professor Marquardt at Fort Wayne dealing with the history of the doctrinal controversy. And let's see, who at Seminex is putting one out? Fred Danker? And I've heard that John Constable is going to take a whack at one. So looks like we're going to have to keep it a four-hour course next year just to read all this stuff. Yes, is it Eric? Who has a...
I heard they were going to make a movie out of that book. Is that true?
With Chris Dodge doing the thing. Yes.
Is Clayton Publishing House going to do it?
You mean for us? Gee, that's a possibility. Clayton Publishing House is doing Dankers, I guess. The Preuss-Otten controversy, it's called. We don't know who's going to print it, ours yet. We have several bids. Yes, Doug?
Anything on Professor Lee Jordahl? I mean, I heard it rumored at one time that he was quitting out where he was, give him a year, and then we'd try to call him or something like this.
Remains a possibility. Lee Jordahl has accepted a call from... He was professor of... All of you know Lee, Lee Jordahl is a member of the LCA and a professor of historical theology with an occasional worship concentration at Gettysburg Seminary of the LCA. And he has accepted a position as librarian of, is it Augsburg College? No. It's an Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa, beginning next fall. He is of some interest to some of us because of his rather courageous statements published as editorials in Dialogue magazine on the Preuss statement and the Missouri Synod controversy. I mean, he has had the candor to say that while he has some difficulties with Missouri's traditional doctrinal position, he recognizes in the Preuss position, as he calls it, solid, unretracted Missourianism. And very, very blunt, and has received an awful lot of persecution, frankly, from people in the LCA and ALC and Missouri for having shot down the argument that the Preuss position and A statement represented some kind of novelty. Well, Jordahl also happens to be one of the most knowledgeable people, I think, in Lutheranism in the country on worship, Lutheran worship. Particularly its history, and we have him teaching a course this summer as a... John, it's in one of the short terms. What's the name of the course? Do you know?
It's in worship. I don't recall.
It's one of our 9-day courses. I don't know if you've heard about those, but we're offering some 9-day courses in summer school this summer. Each course carries 3 hours of credit, and you take one course only for 9 days, but there are going to be some days. Lee is teaching one of those, and what you're suggesting as a possibility might indeed occur. I've talked very pointedly to Lee about why don't you join the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, if that's the way you really feel. Maybe that's the best place for you to minister, and if you did, I would always be interested in your coming here as a professor. I think he's very much interested in that possibility, but we'll have to wait and see. I've talked to some very interesting people about positions here. Another LCA man who has lost his position is somewhat interested in a position. This is Oliver Olson, the man who, let's see, he's losing his job unless the rumor that Bob Marshall has stepped in to intervene is true at Philadelphia Seminary, the LCA. Olson is also quite a worship scholar. His specialty is in 16th century, and he is perhaps best known in the current debate on the New Lutheran Book of Worship because of his articles criticizing the excessive emphasis on sacrificial ritual as compared with sacramental accent in the new ILCW communion rite. He's a possibility too, but he's still in the LCA, and we cannot call men to the faculty who are not members of churches in fellowship with us. Well, you've been most patient. You notice some guys are getting up and leaving. Feel free that's if you have a commitment of some kind, feel free to do that. Yes?
Might be able to come to Sunday school too.
Dr. Philip, yes, that's glad you mentioned that. I've had another letter from Dr. Brooke, Peter Brooke, who was here some time back, just this week. And when he left, he had offered to help us in any way he could. Well, I didn't know at the time whether that was kind of a euphemism, something you say when you're leaving, or what, but he evidently meant that much more seriously than you would have had to understand it, because he's written me again about his great interest in coming here to teach occasionally. And we're looking into the possibility. I'm going to be calling the chairman of the history department at Washington University to see, for example, whether the two institutions could cooperate in bringing a man like this here every year for a special four-week period, let us say, and we'd do something different in the curriculum but offer a credit course in his specialty in the historical department. And I think this I'm really intrigued by because he's such a delightful chap. Yes?
Do you think you'll teach in the near future?
I sure would love to. If you could get somebody to do my job, I think, John, am I slated to teach one course next year?
Yes, you are.
Oh, for goodness sake. In what department?
You'll be teaching.
I really, our ideal here is that all administrators in the academic area, including the president, academic dean, dean of students, should teach. And I just mentioned three who aren't. And that's the ideal. We're working toward it, and I think all three of us are scheduled to do something next year. If we can't succeed, however, in the classroom, we may have to go back to administration. That seems to be a lot easier. Yes, you want your second shot, please.
First of all, what is being done presently to identify students early in their seminary career who are interested in foreign missions or even domestic missions? What could be done in addition, and if possible, is there any thought towards setting up a specific curriculum for these, perhaps even sharing, like with other schools, maybe getting some first aid courses at some of the other institutions around town or whatever might apply to foreign vicarages or foreign missions?
Who's on top of the... Roland, are you been working with the Board for Missions on this kind of thing? Identification early of potential mission people? Would you like to comment? I think you're more on top of it than I.
I guess it's rather casual at the present time, but not altogether any effective. My office, the Office of the Director of School Education, and the Office of the Director of Vicarage are all points at which the kind of awareness about students' intentions, aspirations, etc., might become noticed. We then seek to make the earliest possible contact between the instrument student and the executive personnel of the Board of Missions from Paul's Parable. We are in a developmental state at both of our seminaries with regard to programs of special training for Hispanic ministries and for Black ministries. So to the extent that such programs are available or potentially available, we are directing people toward them. However, that is an area which must yet happen. In the meantime, we are planning to have a meeting, hopefully, between representatives of board missions and of the two seminaries concerning what it takes to make foreign missions vicarages viable. There's been a lot of talk, a lot of interest in it, but it has all been so terribly, terribly fuzzy that it would be almost the ordeal of Engels studying in places where they ought not to go. I wish we could say something more definitive, I guess, but it's certainly underway in a lot of different ways.
We're alert, I think very much alert to the need for it and the recognition that we're not doing very much at either seminary. It's been a pretty slow process. And the other problem with it is that I don't think either seminary expected 3 years ago, you know, when the fourth year men today were first year men, that when you were fourth year men, there would be requests for 28 foreign missionaries. That's how suddenly this overseas thing has opened up. And I think the whole nature of the mission call is so different from what it was years ago. The man who takes a foreign assignment, this is not usually the jungle hut in deep dark Africa. You know, it's usually in a modern city, but engaged in a teaching ministry, teaching evangelists and catechists and helping a new church get organized. It's a very, very challenging work, and I think we need to kind of not only spot the men who are interested, but we need to learn a great deal more about what it entails, you know, what the day-to-day work of a missionary in Manila is. So I think we're, on faculty level, very much interested in expanding this kind of thing you're talking to, Dennis, and I think if you have some good ideas, perhaps Roland Hotman would be as good a man as any as director of placement to just to rap about it and maybe come up with some things we could begin doing next year already. Herb, you want to?
Yeah, just one thing. You mentioned at the beginning that in the near future there are going to be about 600 vacancies. I was just wondering, does that include churches at which the assistant pastor's position is vacant, or is that just counting churches where there are no pastors at all?
I must confess, I don't know how that's counted. And I have a feeling that it's not done very systematically, and not done on the basis of the same kind of criteriology. Fred Niedner of the Nebraska District, for example, was sitting around a table in a meeting where I was a couple of weeks ago, and he said, you know, if I count all of my vacancies, I have over 50 vacancies in the Nebraska District. That boggles your mind. I said, 50? What do you have, a total of about 150 congregations? Yeah, he said, well, of course, that's counting places where they want an assistant but don't have an assistant. That's counting where you have, you know, areas where you have a lot of rural congregations, maybe three that are being served by one man, and each of the congregations would like to have a pastor. So I don't know if when Niedner comes to the Council of Presidents and they sit in this room and poll the delegation to see how many vacancies there are, and if Niedner says 50, and another man is only counting the actual, absolutely necessary vacancies, and he says 21. I think you're going to have the figure may be a little bit soft. But I don't know. Dave, do you have a comment on the number?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
At the end of 74, according to the statistical department downtown, the vacant congregations were 480. So I think the 600 is vacant congregations.
I have a feeling it probably is. This vacancy thing, I think we need to do more than recruit. We need to, as a church body, I think we just have to recognize that times have changed, and not every congregation in rural America or in urban America that formerly was served by its own pastor is going to need its own pastor in the future. I don't think we have the people to do it. We need to think in terms of consolidation of congregations and services. I think we're in an urban area where we have congregations 2 miles apart. We can devise new and different ways of taking care of the pastoral needs of these congregations. You know, team ministries where one man serves 4 or 5 congregations with his specialty and so on. And we need to encourage congregations to merge where this can be done. Yeah.
Been the idea of the faculty having a meeting or
or attending a course where they would discuss teaching methods?
Yes, that's right. We have, and we're very much interested in it as a faculty. Our regular faculty meeting structure is set up so that we have two business meetings a month, every other Tuesday, the exception of the fifth, and the alternate Tuesdays are devoted to forums. One of those two forums monthly is devoted to pedagogy. And then within the departments, the discussion of teaching methodology is part of the usual fare in a department. In fact, we're having a meeting tomorrow. This is Wednesday. We're having a meeting tomorrow to discuss, among other things, teaching methodology, philosophy of education, where is the system going? The question that, was it you asked it, Dennis? No, the man behind you, about the senior college and the two seminaries, and what are the differences, what are the similarities, what about enriched curricula? But the whole question of education at the seminary is the subject of a meeting tomorrow.
Well, I was actually referring to teaching devices that the professor would use in class. Maybe giving him new ideas as to what he might do in class, plan his classes.
We have had some lectures. I take it probably your question, if I know students, is really a suggestion that maybe something along this line should be done. And whether you're being very gentle and very kind, if that's the way you're asking it, because I think we recognize that. This faculty would be the first to say that it doesn't consider itself the end product of excellence in teaching. Many of the men came right out of parishes, and some have taught before and others have not. And we've kind of determined to grow, you know, to work at it, and not to be too uptight when we're criticized. So I would just say, you know, at any point, approach the profs with suggestions you have about methodology, and if that doesn't work too well, go to the department chairman, Harm, Augie Soflo, Bob Herber, and if you don't feel that that's helping too much, go to the academic dean, and if that doesn't get you anywhere, always try me. But we do want to grow and improve, and we think that some of us are better than others at methodologies and all of that. So don't hold back on any suggestions for trying new devices. Some of these are going to be discussed tomorrow. Who hasn't asked a question? You haven't, have you? Go ahead.
I was just wondering if you would know roughly what the number of ministers is who are holding like administrative jobs on districts, the nautical level, or within the nautical school system, who might be able to be freed to fill some of these vacancies, and if SUNY would or is considering changing any types of regulations which mandate that ordained ministers hold some of these offices.
I think it's an excellent idea and question, but I personally don't know of any study. I wouldn't be surprised if some studies may have been done by the Bureau of Research and Statistics downtown, but I don't know of them. I think it ought to be looked into, because one of the reasons we're having money problems in the Senate is because in the last 5 years there's been a phenomenal increase in the amount of money spent at the district level. And when you break the district increase down, the increase is, in most cases, attributable to salary figures. And salaries, in turn, mean more execs at the district level. So there's been a decentralization in staff function in the Senate. And I think, you know, if we're really concerned about the vacancy situation and meeting the needs of the church, we need an overall study that we all agree to work at and to live by that would identify the really necessary administrative positions at the Senate level and the district level, fill them with good men, but fill as many as we can with laymen. And there are more and more laymen retiring from Army and Air Force and business at the age of 50, 55, who could handle some of these positions, I think. So I appreciate the comment, and I'll inquire myself once and see whether something like that has been done. If it hasn't been, I think perhaps it should. John?
There's a staff report on the Constitution, bylaws, and structure of the Missouri Synod that's supposed to be studying the whole issue. That's the thing you mentioned before Johnson and turned down the
yes.
lawsuit. And they hope to report in 79 at the convention, I think. So maybe some of this will develop out of that whole assignment.
It's a good point. It could well result in some streamlining, that's for sure. And the streamlining might mean fewer men. Let's take, there were a couple over here. Let's see, this man hasn't asked one yet, okay?
When I describe the seminary to people, I sometimes refer to it as a melting pot, where there are a lot of people from different backgrounds and different schools. And I think this is a good atmosphere, this melting pot atmosphere, where you have ex-colonels in the Air Force and people that went through Fort Wayne. But I think sometimes at the seminary, in this melting pot type situation, that in these diverse backgrounds that people have had, maybe they've had experience in certain areas that sometimes the seminary, I think, should honor academically. Now, as for instance, I know that they the seminary does not make graduates of like the teacher's college take this education course. But I think that other people have had experiences at the seminary that maybe they could get documented that they would not have to take these, take some of these required courses. I can give them, for instance, from my own experience, that I don't mean, you know, this is not a brag on my own part, but I know there are other students that are very capable in some certain areas. But I have been making hospital calls with my father since I was old enough to go into the hospital. And this pastoral relations course, I'm really not, it's not telling you anything I don't know already, you know. And I would have much rather liked to have taken this ministry to the age or this course on eschatology, but I had to take this course. And I was wondering if there's any feeling in the faculty to maybe try and, if a student can document his experiences and get references, that maybe he can be passed out or skip certain courses because of the wide diversity of background we do have at the seminary.
Well, I think it's an excellent question again, and one that I feel a great deal of personal sympathy with. It's very, one of the things, I don't speak as an old pro at administration because I was not in administration until a few years ago. But I know that one of the things we must do, we who have the responsibility of administering a school, we must do this in a very even-handed way. It must be fair above all else. I mean, what you do must be no more and no less than what your peers do. And we have to strive for objectivity and fairness in setting and administering the standards of the school. There are, you know, as soon as you get into equivalencies, testing out, you know, enriched courses for those who qualify, you're going to get involved in an increased amount of subjective judgment on the part of somebody at the institution. You know, there's just no way out of that. If you're a smoother talker than the man next to you, as you approach the same question, you probably would get in and he would not. You know, how do we keep the thing even-handed? Well, having said that and having recognized that, I think nevertheless we ought to strive for it. One thing I don't favor, and I guess that's the academician in me, I don't see a reduction in seminary work in such situations.